Hey, folks, and welcome to the podcast. This week's guest is Bill Kopp. He is an author, and his new book is called Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records and the Rise of New Wave. I found it quite interesting because I think around this time, the late 1970s, a lot of small labels like this sprung up out of the vacuum, out of these little organic scenes that popped up, and record labels sort of followed them, and they made fans that connected in a heartfelt way that perhaps major labels can't do, because these were such local products, bands that folks were going to see in person, tangentially perhaps knew, and just the local press, the local radio, the local record labels sort of all combined to make something happen, and I don't think that sort of ever happened before quite like this. So these records really mean a lot to people, and so this book talks about this whole scene and the way it evolved and the way it sort of rode up and down. So quite interesting to music historians and to lots of folks on lots of levels. I want to also point out, because I neglected to do this in the interview, that Bill got a lot of great ephemera and photographs, and there's lots and lots of cool images in the book, so it helps kind of round it out into a special package. So once again, it's Bill Kopp, and his website is blog.musoscribe.com if you're interested, and the book is called Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records and the Rise of New Wave. Hope you enjoy our chat, and I will hopefully talk to you soon. Thanks. Okay, I think we have Bill Kopp on the telephone. Bill is a longtime music journalist, and he has written this book we've been talking about this morning called Disturbing the Peace, 415 Records and the Rise of New Wave. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing great. I really enjoyed the book. It sort of tells the story of how two guys who are, you know, between them, hustlers, accidental radio DJs, record store workers, concert promoters, music journalists, how they start a record company in San Francisco in 1978. And it's quite interesting to see sort of how the labels, growing pains and ups and downs sort of mirror or were the exact opposite of what was going on in mainstream culture and in the music business. It's a very interesting story.
Thank you. I'm glad you think so. A big reason why I wanted to write the book is because when I sort of scratched the surface and started finding out a little bit about 415, I discovered the same thing. It's like, wow, what an interesting story and an object lesson in a lot of ways too.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. It tells a little bit of history, you know, whether you like it or not. When I read the book, I got the feeling that everyone involved pretty much felt that they were doing something special, that there was this really unique energy surrounding the whole enterprise of 415 Records right from the start. Am I right?
Yeah, that was my impression as well. I mean, Howie Klein, the co-founder of the label, emphasized to me, he probably mentioned this in every single one of our many, many interviews, that it was mainly about fun for him and not for profit, which is quite handy since there wasn't any profit, really.
Yeah. The timing is sort of, I think, super important. Like I said earlier, first record, 1978. I think that's sort of vital to why they succeeded. There was sort of a vacuum in the marketplace.
Yeah, that's the way I see it as well. You know, the punk, as it were, was really bubbling under. It wasn't really a commercial force at that point, certainly not in the United States anyway. But there was a lot happening musically, and the majors weren't interested, not at first.
Yeah, although you point out in the book how as soon as there's like a whiff of success, the majors are sort of tripping over themselves to buy contracts from 415 and eventually to buy the whole label.
Exactly right. And that brought with it all manner of changes, some good, some not so good, but certainly the profile of a number of the groups who were on 415 was raised considerably thanks to the deal with Columbia CBS, yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's also interesting how this it takes place in San Francisco, which really not that many years before 1978 was, you know, the flowers in your hair place. You know, this would have been a different story, I think, if it were New York or L.A. or somewhere else. You know, I think it's, am I right that Howie Klein goes to see the Ramones and he really literally it just changes his the whole course of his life. But is there something that you think is San Francisco, you know, that makes this a San Francisco story?
Well, yeah, because this was, you know, not to belabor an obvious point, but because this was long before the era of the internet, the scenes that were happening in different American cities or even cities around the world were largely disconnected from one another. You know, if you lived in L.A., maybe you picked up a copy of New York Rocker and read it, and as a result, you had a little bit of a sense of what was going on in New York City, but otherwise, you kind of didn't. And so this scene in San Francisco, which was concentrated among, you know, not a small number of bands, but certainly a small number of venues for them to play in a fairly concentrated geographical area, it was happening separate, completely separate from the scene in L.A. and things like that. And so there is a very San Francisco character to the bands, even though one sounds completely unlike another.
Yeah, it's interesting. You tell the story of the label by just going through the history, but also sort of going record by record chronologically and talking about what's happening with that band and what's happening with the label. And one of the nice parts is that first, just internally, because there is no other alternative, the bands sort of have to share information, share bills, share publicity, and then it turns that same thing happens on the level of the label. The labels, the indie labels, sort of have to share information and share ways of getting this information out without the internet around, and it's kind of a nice part of the story.
Yeah, there was kind of a networking vibe to the whole thing, and in particular, the way that 4 and 5 worked to get the story of its artists out to the larger marketplace, the entire country. Howie Klein in particular was engaging in what we would now call relationship marketing, guerrilla marketing, even though, you know, to some extent those terms didn't really exist, and certainly within the music industry, that's not really the way things were done. But a lot of the success, however limited that those bands had, was, you know, a lot of it was down to that kind of networking.
Yeah, that one-on-one sort of thing. I think everybody has records that on a personal level sort of define a time and a place for them, records that sort of mean more emotionally than you know, you like them more than a rational person would like a record because it connects to you. And I get the feeling that with the 4-1 catalog, it's like that for you. Am I right? Is that partly why you wrote the book?
Yeah, very much so. As fascinating as the early groups are in the kind of what we'll call the indie period of 4-1-5, I wasn't familiar with a lot of that material, a lot of those artists, until I began doing the research for the book. When I was in college, however, two of my very favorite albums, really the soundtrack of my college years, happened to be Wire Train's second album, Between Two Words, and Translator's fourth album, Evening and Harvest. So I had interviewed the guys from Translator before for other stories, but the opportunity to really dig into this and talk to some of the people who made some of the music that really, again, was the sort of the soundtrack of my college years was a big draw for me. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, I think that comes through in the book, your sort of love for this stuff. The book shows an image of a contract, which is like a paragraph. It's half a typed page, I think, you know.
Yes.
And over and over, it comes up in the book that, you know, the principals never made any real money. And number one, I'm never sure if that's reality or what that means, or, you know, whose definition of that is real. But I couldn't tell why that was. You know, it seemed like on one level they were just putting the money back into the label, but it did seem like they had what some people would call regional hits. I mean, what do you think the bottom line is for that?
Chris Kanab talks about that when he sold his interest, I think he got $1,000.
Yeah, $1,000.
Howie Klein went on to a very, very successful career to Warner Reprise and beyond. But they didn't make any money, and the artists didn't really make any money. It was funneled back into support for the label. One of the reasons that Howie made a deal with the devil, as it were, with CBS Columbia, was because he saw the band's Rub Your Void in particular, starting to have a certain level of success, and realized that what they needed to go to the next level, and by the next level, I mean touring in a van as opposed to a station wagon, and sleeping in a motel rather than a station wagon, would mean that they would need, the kind of funding that that 4 & 5 simply did not have the wherewithal to do. And so, you know, these major labels are knocking at the door, and he knew that there was going to be a huge downside to that. But the potential upside was something that he felt like he needed to provide for his bands.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and it is fascinating how, I mean, I've heard the same story so many times about major labels just not seeing what was there, or not willing to believe in something, or treating something like product that is, you know, art. And it's just over and over, I hear that story over and over again. Anyway, that's a super fascinating part of the story. Once they do get this kind of influx of money, how it does good and bad. It's a fascinating book. And like I said, it just mirrors so many other scenes in other cities and other little labels. And I think folks interested in any of that, or in the history of these actual bands, or just in your passion about this, should check it out. Your website is blog.musoscribe.com, Bill Kopp. Thank you so much, and best of luck with the book. I know it comes out in just a couple of days. Congratulations, and thanks for talking with us this morning.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks so much.
My car.